Welcome to Cityscape, a podcast from the Committee for Sydney. Professor Peter Bishop is one of Britain's prominent urban designers and the director at the architecture firm Allies and Morrison. Professor Bishop was selected to head up Lord Mayor Ken Livingstone's architectural and design unit, Design for London. His career-long fascination is with the strategies and approaches that can be employed to shape cities within existing social, economic and political frameworks. Professor Bishop was in Sydney and caught up with our chief executive, Dr. Tim Williams.
So, Peter, welcome to Sydney again. I think this is your second visit in less than a year, isn't it?
Third visit.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So why are you in Sydney this time?
Well, the last two visits have been with UTS, where I've got a kind of visiting professor role. And the purpose of this was to look at ways in which UTS can build stronger links with city government and with business and with practice to really think about his own research agendas and how he can sharpen those and make them really relevant to some of the key issues the city is facing and critically get impact out of research.
So we'll develop that conversation. Just to go back one step to sort of to explain to some people who might not have come across you before, why haven't they been to Committee for Sydney events? I don't know. But so, Peter, your background, actually, as you would say, partly in practice, so in local government as a chief planner, and then in running the Design for London back, I guess, almost 10 years ago now, but essentially setting it up and backing and running it. And then and more recently, a mixed role, I think, right? Partly academic and still have one foot in a kind of commercial camp, working with an architect or a...
With Allies & Morrison, which is a kind of large London firm.
Yeah. So let's go back. One of the reasons you came to, or you spoke about in Sydney, one of the visits was around your experience with King's Cross, and that was very important to us because you come at a really important point in the whole discussion about what the role of planning is in making a city. We've got the Greater Sydney Commission just produced its new plan for Sydney. You've got the whole thing about what kind of skills are required, even down to actually what are we trying to do with our cities. And one of the great things that you did when you came and gave a talk about King's Cross was to talk about, I think you call it the dark matter of the deal between the public and the private sector, but it's like, you know, at the end of the day, it's still a deal between a good public sector and a good private sector that led to King's Cross being a success, right? So let's go back to that moment first. Let's do a little bit about the King's Cross story, and you published a book about it as well. So.
The King's Cross story, well, I suppose in the time I've been in practice, I'm now in academia and work for a commercial firm, but when I work for government, the thing that sort of strikes you if you work for a long time in government is that planning doesn't really achieve much. Now, you can draw up plans, and the plans can be wonderful plans, they can be beautiful plans, but actually, unless somebody is prepared to drive them through and navigate the dark matter of politics, then actually not very much is going to happen. And increasingly in my career, I became far more interested in the art of the possible as to how somebody in city government could use that position to try and help people who wanted to do good things do them by navigating the complexities of the politics and the bureaucracies in order to make things happen. The King's Cross scheme was a six-year planning process, six-year intensive negotiation, and you know, and I think I'm biased, but I think it's a good scheme. It's getting global recognition as being a good scheme. But the critical things about it were not so much the master plan or the design, both of which I think are good, but actually the process that allowed a innovative and a really good developer to produce a really good scheme. Things like the land ownership arrangements, things like the commercial deal, the fact that the landowners were prepared to not take a sum of money up front but kept a long-term stake in the scheme, and the fact that, therefore, long-term quality was going to determine value. And that's fundamentally different from the standard model in London and actually in Sydney.
I mean, this is such a crucial debate here, where government has effectively, over many years, disempowered itself of what I think is its city-making role and essentially sold land at top dollar without constraints, without policy, effectively to the private sector. And I think a very different result can be achieved by having a different approach to procurement, different approach to land disposal, and the whole long-term engagement between the public and the private sector. And the King's Crossing, I think, is a perfect example of that, because I don't think the results, which everybody loves there, would have been achieved without those models. And
And without a developer who also understand placemaking. I mean, placemaking is a word we bandy around rather too loosely, but actually putting in the effort to make the place work from day one and make it a place that people wanted to go to with the elements in terms of design, in terms of events, in terms of land uses. But the interesting thing, again, about King's Cross for me was the fact it required a group of people to come together to make it happen. And this thing about land value. And if you, as government, if you sell land, you know, you're never, ever going to get the right price.
Absolutely.
You're either going to undersell it, which means you're selling yourself short, or you're more likely to oversell it and completely constrain the quality of that development. Yeah. In Sydney, with what looks like an almost everlasting rising market, the prediction I think one can make from government is that the land stake will be worth more in 10 years' time than at the point of sale. And therefore, as far as a public purse is concerned, it is prudent to keep a stake in and put all the efforts of government behind making that land as valuable as possible by creating a place which would be brilliant in 10, 15, 20, 30 years' time.
I think that's a brilliant way of putting it, Peter. You know, it's like criminal to sell it in those circumstances. You know, I mean, the family silver doesn't that really have to be given away in that way. And I think that is important. I think the other point you make, though, is two things I wanted to say. One is around a good, in the King's Cross example, a good public sector elicited a great response from a good private sector developer, you know, i.e., the way in which the deal was done and the culture that was created around it actually, in a sense, attracted a good developer. The process identified a good developer, and they were a great developer in the process. The other bit I think you haven't mentioned, I think you're too modest to mention, actually, but I think is real, is that the accountability side of it. You were there as the representative of the council in which the King's Cross is to be found. And I think that's another missing element to, you know, in Sydney, not in the city of Sydney, which has got a very strong council, which, you know, when there are big projects and there are multiple partners, you know, I think they're pretty clear about how to represent the public interest in this thing. But sometimes that's very difficult to do in Sydney, where there are big projects which are often done by a government silo that has a very distant relationship with the local council in its area. So you end up with projects being done to areas with nobody representing the kind of local place or the long-term interests of that community. And I think that Camden was very hot on working out how to leverage the best out of that development. But your role was also to not just police it, but actually to bring ideas to the table to make it a success. So you're a partner. We don't see enough of that, I think, in the Sydney context.
I was very fortunate in Camden. I had the political leadership was very enlightened, was willing to step outside its parochial political interests and take risks to achieve something which was going to be of lasting value. It was prepared to empower me as a government official to negotiate and back me, and prepared to set a vision rather than try and micromanage it. And that was fundamental. The other thing was fundamental, which was, again, very unusual, is my chief executive gave me an unlimited budget to negotiate with a view that, you know, you can't negotiate with the private sector, you know, without the funds to bring in the best consultants and do the research and build the case so you can argue it objectively and win the case.
See, what I love about all this is that you started by saying this, but I'll reinforce it. You know, it isn't just about planning. It is about planning, but it isn't just about planning. It isn't just about having the right ideas on placemaking and urban design. It's having the right tools or the right incentives in place or the right structures in place, actually. Yeah. These things people don't talk enough about, but the business model, in a sense, to actually deliver the right results, right? Yeah. And I think King's Cross proves that as much as anything. Now, on the basis of experience like that, you were then asked to take on the role of doing design for London with Richard Rogers as chair.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about what your objectives were when you went into Design for London and a couple of the things that you think you established there?
Yeah, Design for London was one of those amazing career opportunities that you're fortunate enough to have. And it was the mayor's architectural studio. It sat half in and half out of government. The mayor gave us license to innovate and also license to upset people by asking questions. We had no power and no money. And the good thing about that was you got no powers, you got no responsibilities, you got no money, you're not linked, you're not shackled by all of the, sensible requirements about how you spend public money. But it forced us to go out and work in partnership. And it forced us to think about kind of big ideas, communicate them in simple terms, build alliances, and then start doing them. So some of the projects, the 100 public spaces for London, which resulted not in 100 public spaces, but things like the partial pedestrianisation of Exhibition Road in Kensington, a whole series of public space schemes in some of the poorest communities, town centre regeneration in some of the poorest communities. Yeah, I've looked back on with pride. We did a lot of work around trying to soften the hard edges of the London Olympics, which is a sports campus, and try and set the conditions where it could turn into a living piece of city. Yeah. We looked at big regeneration ideas for East London, things like the Green Enterprise District, the London Cable Car. I brought in Siemens as a major partner. Yeah. And the best compliment we ever paid was the Architects Journal described us as the guerrilla warfare wing of architecture. And the whole Design for London approach was to try and work very quietly, big ideas, simple communication, build alliances, get stuff happening, invest money in advocacy and debate.
I think it was very important, at a time when London was sort of going through some of the things Sydney's going through now, which is that a lot of growth, a lot of investments coming at us from all angles, and not enough had been done on how do we make sure it's a quality development rather than just quantity in London. And I think also that at a time when a lot of the councils didn't have enough of the skills to deal with this stuff, but you therefore could help some of them where there was resource to do so, to actually experience this change and pick on some key projects and processes which might improve the result. And I thought it was an incredibly good thing. And I also liked, you say simple things, but even your mapping, it was interesting when you came to talk to the Committee for Sydney a few months ago and you showed I think it was the London High Street thing that you'd done, which effectively looked at the street westward back to, almost to the London border, as a kind of continuous high street for London. I liked that kind of slightly off the wall way of looking at the city, and I think it enabled people to look at the city in a slightly different fashion. So when you went on to become an academic and then also to keep one foot in practice, as it were, so what are your big interests now? You've just published the book on King's Cross, which I found very, very useful. And people here, by the way, because we're obviously going through, we've got Central Station happening, and it's kind of interesting. By the way, on that one, one of the things I'm trying to say to the public sector is that just because your land holding has a limited red line, that doesn't mean that that's the red line for the project. If Transport for New South Wales only owns this amount of land, maybe the project is bigger than its land ownership, but you have to have a partnership with somebody on the edge of the land ownership, So it's they've got to think of it. In this particular country, we don't do that very much. People do projects within their land ownership, where I'm used to people forging partnerships beyond their land ownerships, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and the local authorities often helping people to come together around that, or somebody like English Partnerships maybe playing that role. So I'm trying to get people here to think of that project, not as that project, but as that project.
So I think there are two critical things that a good planner can bring in to a negotiation. One is, as you've said, I'm not interested in the red line around your boundary. I'm interested in what happens outside it.
Yeah.
And to force that debate, You know, if you're employed as an architect, your client doesn't want you spending money outside the boundary. And that's the debate with where the city could actually really enrich the quality of the scheme by thinking about context and how it meshes in with the its surroundings, not just physically, but also socially and economically, and becomes a part of the city. And the second is the idea of what happens next, something which we really neglect. And I did write a book on temporary urbanism because I did become very interested in this idea we're trained as architects, planners, to believe what we do is the final solution for the city. Actually, we have temporary stewardship. And what we do is either open-ended, which allows the next generation to do something better, or it closes down opportunities. I think the other thing city planning can do to a developer is say, you know, what will happen in 10 years' time or 20 years' time to the sites around? What can you do to try and actually make the moves and create the conditions where when somebody comes to develop the site next to you in 10 years' time, they'll have the ability to do something even better than just develop their site in isolation. So it's thinking about future continuity, which is actually very, very lacking, I think, in the certainly in planning and architecture and education.
The last thing I want to ask you about is work you've just done or been part of with the Centre for London, a really excellent report, which we're ripping off here at the Community of Sydney, called Street Smarts, Report of the Commission on the Future of London's Roads and Streets. Centre for London, actually, the son of the former chair of Design for London, Richard Rogers' son, Ben, runs it.
Yeah.
Friends of ours involved in it together, Richard Brown. It's a great report. I think it genuinely, it brings a number of different players together, public and private, to look for the next 30 years, really, of transport planning, not tomorrow, but actually to set out some principles about, you know, and I think from my point of view, the most important stuff is got interesting stuff about autonomous vehicles, but the most interesting stuff is around having a clear understanding of the hierarchy of road users and the difference between a road and a street, actually.
Yeah.
And I just want to talk about this in conclusion, because I can tell you we have millions of strodes in Sydney and in Australian cities. These are things that don't know whether they're a road or a street.
Yeah.
You may have seen them in your visits to Sydney. You know,
quite a few of them.
Quite a few of them, right? So any thoughts about that and reflections on what we need to do, actually?
Yeah. Well, it's like an off-the-cuff definition, but a road, I would say, is far more orientated towards the motor car or vehicles than the street, as a kind of rough working definition. This particular report, you know, through the Centre of London, independent, but part of this purpose was to ask the questions which the mayor would probably feel uncomfortable asking. In other words, push the transport agenda into the next phase of development. But working on this kind of continuity in London over the 20 years, Transport for London has moved from a highways authority to a transport authority. Massive and hugely successful investment in rail and particularly buses, and more recently in public realm and cycling. So it's to try and pick up that direction of travel and to reinforce this idea of hierarchy, which we've been fairly comfortable with in London for probably 10 to 15 years, but needs to be reinforced that actually you design first of all around the pedestrian, secondly around the cyclist, thirdly around public transport users, fourthly around essential freight and commercial vehicles, and finally, lastly, around the car. Now, you don't exclude the car.
No.
Yeah, we recognise that in certain parts of outer London, the car is the primary means of personal transport and is likely to remain so. But to start looking at the next policy direction in terms of reinforcing the hierarchy, making it far more beneficial through incentives, financial and other, to walk or cycle rather than use the car, and in particular start to think about the degree to which the city subsidises the car in terms of how it gives it road space, parking space, how it gives it the priorities in movement around the city, and try and redress that particular balance. And out of it in particular, coming back to the hierarchy, to think about how we take the next stages in really trying to improve the public realm of the city, both in terms of the quantity of it, but also, you know, the safety, the comfort of using it, the enjoyment of using it, and how it becomes a critical element of the city.
It's really important. You know, it's a fundamental discussion of importance in this city, that the difference between a street and a road, the hierarchy of users, be respected in the way that we build a city. And at the moment, I think there's lots of confusion. Part of our problem is that journey that you said Transport for London was on, from being a highways authority to being a transport authority. We're halfway down that road, literally. So yeah, we've still got an agency whose job title is to build roads. Mm. And I don't think we can make progress until we have a completely unified transport department whose metrics are about access more than mobility, frankly. So essentially, we've still got some problems, which is why this report is really important. And what you've said is important, because we fundamentally have to shift the city more towards that hierarchy of users, to recognize that these mass transit is not a 19th century notion, it's a 21st century notion.
Yeah.
And that the private car is actually not just wasteful of energy, but actually in this city destructive of value, and that we actually really need to push more towards the direction of a modal shift. And I think, just to sort of come to this, and then I'll talk to you about your visit this time. Our challenge, we've just had a transport futures report published, which is very good, but it doesn't have at its heart at the moment a commitment to a modal shift from X to Y. And I believe we can't really shift the culture and change practice unless we actually have some targets on these things. I don't know if you agree with that, but that's our view actually in the committee. Last thing. So great, it's great. We really benefit from having voices like yours who've done stuff, which is both relevant and I think incentivizes us to do better. So you're very, very welcome, and it's very useful when you come to on these visits. Just a couple of reflections from you about what you've just talked at the beginning about your role and what you're trying to do with UTS. Mm. I think there's a couple of things that I'd like to ask you about that. My view is that in a city that hasn't got a strong metropolitan governance model, it's almost more important that we have collaborations between strategically powerful players, private sector, Committee of the City tries to do that, universities. Universities have not played as much in this space as they might have done. We see some of this coming from Western Sydney University in Western Sydney. Mm. UTS is a really critical part of the Sydney scene. So you're hoping it's going to kind of step up to actually identify some of the key agendas for making a good city over the next couple of years?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, UTS is very well linked internationally with other cities and other universities. And you know, one thing you realise when you travel is that all cities are suffering from basically the same problems. Housing, you know, housing and affordability, transportation and movement, environmental impact, whilst at the same time all of those try to maintain a city economy that's dynamic, shortage of land and equitable distribution of the gains across the population. That's probably it. And you could tick those for Sydney, tick those for New York, London, Paris, Tokyo, probably Shanghai and Beijing as well. So these are universal problems. However, the solutions are not universal, and the solutions have to be city-based. One of the big mistakes that some cities make is they go and see the High Line in New York and say, we've got a High Line in our city. It's not quite like that. So copying initiatives and trying to transplant them rarely works. I think where UTS and actually other universities in Sydney can play a really key role is to work with partners to identify the critical cracks, the boundaries between various areas where further knowledge is needed in order to refine either quite simple policy responses or very, very long-term policy initiatives for the city. And going back to the earlier discussion about King's Cross, I think that what kind of interests me most about cities is that when you really look at what fundamentally can change a city, it is quite often not the obvious. It can be shifts in building regulations, different requirements on density and plot ratios, things like that, which can have a fundamental effect. And I've always said rather flippantly that the two things that changed London was cheap airfares, which allowed people to compare London with other European cities, and a smoking ban that pushed people out of restaurants and created a cafe society. That is flippant, but I think there's some really interesting levers in the city.
Yeah. Well, I look, but
which you can, you know, which if you find them and pull them, can have a dramatic impact on the future shape of that city.
Just to conclude, but to pick up on your not flippant, I think, remarks. I mean, it's interesting that there's a view in Sydney that when the Australian dollar became so powerful and it bought a lot, that there was a lot more travelling internationally than had been going on for some time. Yeah. People came back with stuff saying, we've got to do this to Sydney.
Yeah.
So I think that is not that's a very important thing. The place where I wanted to go at the end was that it has been said of Australian cities, and I might have said it myself, that they are the orphans of public policy, right? Because it's a bit like London in the 80s, where there was no way of having a metropolitan coordination of London, and the city languished a bit.
Yeah.
And I think it's for me, the critical next stage of the debate is how we firm up. We've got a great Sydney Commission. How we push it in the direction of a even greater metropolitan strength and coordination. But I think ultimately accountability. It's very difficult for me to understand how a city can talk to itself without having some political structures to enable that to happen.
Yeah.
And without having the capacity for somebody to knock, or at least attempt to knock, the silos together to collaborate. We've seen it in London, where there's a lot more discussion between the land use planning part and the transport part than there's ever been. And it helps that there's a single force of authority to try and do that. What I was going to say in conclusion also was that you also see that when you've got like a mayor like Ken Livingstone, and even Boris, to be fair, Boris was interested in residential design, and you were involved in doing the design guide for London.
Yeah.
Ken had a more strategic commitment, I think, and a pleasure in actually some innovation around design. I think he was interested in the debate. It wasn't just Richard Rogers. I think the mayor was quite interested. So it struck me that it was an important part of the discussion that you had a governance and a sort of a champion for design for your city. And I think whatever we do in Sydney, we've got to try and get more greater self-government and governance, but also I think try and get whatever political authorities we have, we've got 31 councils, each of them to have a kind of design, it's a cliche, but a design champion, somebody who really cares about this stuff, who can try and push the resources they've got in their own council area in the direction of good design. Do you think that helps?
Yeah, I think the creation of the mayor's office in 2000, and the election of Ken Livingstone were landmarks in London. Yeah. I mean, London from the mid-80s, when London government was abolished by the Thatcher government, up until the end of the 90s, was actually languishing. You know, I seriously considered emigrating in the early 90s. There seemed to be no hope. The establishment of Mayoral government, first of all, started the process, which has been hugely successful, in drawing land use planning and transportation together. A fundamental drive in London, which has allowed widespread regeneration. Secondly, more critically possibly, the mayor established a very clear vision of London as a global city looking outwards that had to address its issues but was competing effectively in New York and had to get its act together. And that kind of galvanised London behind it. And then finally, the governance to address the really critical issues, negotiate with central government or state government, and actually represent the long-term interests of the city. And I'm not going to comment on the situation in Sydney, but I'm not going to suggest you need a mayor, but I think there certainly anything that strengthens the focus behind what a city is, what Sydney is, what it could be, what it mustn't become, and how in the next 10 to 15 critical years of expansion, how it remains and becomes a city fit for purpose. And you need something to drive that.
Peter, on that note, and I'll finish it for you, the answer is we must go towards a more metropolitan self-governance, and if that means a mayor for Greater Sydney at some point, I think that's where it should go. It's complicated, it's difficult. Constitutionally, people think we can't do it. I think this, unless Sydney sorts its governance out, we will have a very difficult situation on our hands, on the move from 5 million to 8 million by 2056. Yeah. So, Peter, on that note, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.